All right, today we have Laura Thompson joining. I'm so excited for this conversation today. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, no problem. It's nice to be here.
Excellent. So we're talking about growth and career path management for engineering orgs. So I guess why don't we start off talking about your career arc, from day zero?
Day zero is a long time ago. So I was lucky. I started coding when I was 8. It turned out that a high school near me had a computer. This is going back a long time. They had an Apple II, and they were bussing in kids that were good at math. And I think everybody else in the program was in 8th grade, and I was in the 4th grade. So I learned to code in Logo on an Apple II that we shared between a whole class of kids. It's kind of funny because you look back now and say, "Yeah, I learned to code in a Lisp," which seems kind of modern at the time. But
Nice.
yeah, I know it's funny. I had a kind of a strange career arc because I dropped out of high school pretty early, and then kind of accidentally fell into my first tech job. And I was sort of apprenticed to a guy who wanted to teach me everything, and he got me really excited about technology. I went from kind of job to job, and the last job I had before I went back to college was really interesting. I was an operations controller, which I guess would be like ops manager. I was 17 years old, so this is kind of surprising. And I don't really know how I talked my way into this, but I talked my way into it by talking about a bunch of like geeky stuff with someone at a party, and they said, "You should come and work here." So I went and worked there, and it was a really interesting place to work. We did IVR stuff. It was clean room environment, and this is back in Australia, and we actually had the first Nexts in Australia. So I got to play with Nexts at a very young age, and that was so
Oh,
much fun.
nice.
Super
Nice.
exciting. So yeah, kind of like it's funny how much Apple there is in that early story for me. But I worked in that for a while, and then there was a recession in Australia at the time, and I got laid off. So I thought I would go back to school and go to college. And so here's the interesting thing. When I started college, and I did computer science and engineering, I have 2 undergraduate degrees, one in hardware, one in software. When I started, the web didn't exist. And that's pretty much what I've done for a career since. I remember the very first day that I saw the World Wide Web. I was in some kind of 24-hour lab, and somebody was like, "Hey, look at this." And they showed me Mosaic, and I was like, "That's awesome. That thing, that's the future right there." And I was like, "This is what I want to do," right? Like, everything else had been fun, but this was like, that was like a real moment I remember of like, this is what I want to do with my career. I was so excited. And then kind of coming through the later years of college, I started a consulting business with the person who's now my husband. And I remember our first gig, we decided we were going to be web developers. So we showed up to this, somebody had put out like an RFP trying to hire somebody to do like web services for a law firm. And this was like something that hadn't been done before, like it was all brand new. And we didn't know what we were doing. I mean, we were kind of undergraduates. We literally had no idea what we were doing. We'd never had like a professional job, that sort of like a serious one. And I remember because we wore suits because they were lawyers, and we thought that that would probably be the right thing to do. And I'm not sure I've ever worn a suit to a tech job interview before or since. And we turned up, we literally had no idea what we were doing. We sort of talked about, they're like, "We want to offer like low cost legal services online. We want people to be able to like write their will with a website and pay us $15, and it'll generate a PDF. And then that's, they've got a will, and that's the cheapest they can do it." Because they said, "That work isn't exciting for lawyers. We would like to automate it, and it's good for people because legal service is really expensive." And this is a good sales pitch, right? They're very forward thinking. And they hired us. And I remember because like when we had been working for a while, they're like, nobody seemed to know what they were doing. All the people we talked to were terrible, but you guys wore suits, so we thought we would hire you because we felt comfortable with you." And I still think that's really funny. We worked on a bunch of stuff with them for a few years. We built one of the first systems in Australia that took online payments, so people could do their wills. They could do powers of attorney. They could apply for immigration, stuff like that, which
Oh,
is,
cool.
seems like par for the course now, but this is like 1995. It's a long time ago. And when we started, we were doing it all in Perl. And I remember because working with a sysadmin at the payments company, interesting guy who actually went on to be like the president of Linux Australia later, and he said, "Oh, so Perl kind of sucks. You should totally try this new language that we've been using. It's called PHP." And they just came out with a new version, which was like PHP 3. This is going back a long way. So we started using that, and I did like it more than Perl, perhaps unsurprisingly. And we built a bunch of websites, had a bunch of clients, did all the stuff in PHP, and we were like, "There's no book for this. Like the online docs are pretty good, but there's no book." And somebody came out with a book, which was, we read it and we didn't like it. And I remember we came home from work one Friday night, we sat down in the pub, and I was like, "We should write a book." And Luke was like, "Yeah, we could do that. We could do that." And not long after that, the person that ended up being our tech editor came into the PHP general mailing list and said, "Look, I'm looking for somebody to write a PHP chapter for an Apache book." And we said, we could do that. And then she emailed us and was like, could it be a whole book? And we're like, sure. And she said, could it also cover MySQL? And, you know, at the time, we didn't know MySQL, had never used it. We were like fully Postgres at that point. And I was like, sure, how hard can it be? Was what I was thinking. You know, there's just, I think the theme through a lot of the early stuff was, sure, we can do that and then go away and teach yourself the thing and then go do the thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's worked out for me pretty well all along.
Sort of the Richard Branson model, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. How hard can it be? You know, which is sometimes it hasn't worked out, but mostly it's worked out pretty well. But beyond that, then, you know, we were consulting. I went to grad school for computer science, and it turns out that consulting and writing books works out really well with going to grad school and being an academic. And so we did this for years, right? And, you know, contributed a lot of open source stuff, gave talks at a lot of open source conferences, and got to know people from like various open source communities. And I ended up moving to the States because I had friends that had founded an open source consulting company, and they kept trying to hire me, and they kept trying to hire me, and they kept trying to hire me. And I kept saying no. But I did kind of regret that I hadn't moved to the US during the first .com boom. Like, it was one of those like, and they're like, you should come and work here. Hmm. And finally, the university that I worked for had like a financial crisis. It's funny because it's a software crisis, so we'll talk about that. You know, they bought a new academic management system and nearly bankrupted the university. It was supposed to cost $12 million and ended up costing $80 million to roll out. You know, the guy that was running like the migration project dropped out of a, you know, heart attack on the way to work. It was super, super stressful. So my friend said to me again, come and work for our company. I was like, sure, I'll come. I'll come work for you on a contract for like 3 months and then I'm going home again. And they were like, sure. And then I got here and they were like, how would you like to be our director of web dev? And I said, okay, sure, I will stay. And I convinced my husband to move to the US as well. He was very skeptical about the whole thing. And then, yeah, that's how we ended up here. I worked there for a couple of years. And then, you know, I decided I wanted to do something different. I left there and I came to work for Mozilla. And I've been at Mozilla for 12 years. That is kind of remarkable to me, because that is like an epoch, right? Especially in the tech industry. But it hasn't been the same job. It's been a different job every year, every 2 years. It's grown massively in that amount of time. So it's been like 6 or 7 different jobs, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So when I started at Mozilla, I came in, I had been like a principal consultant at my previous job, and I went back to being a senior engineer, and I had kind of a crisis at this. I was like, oh my gosh, am I making a horrible career mistake by going back from management into being an IC? And it was pretty funny. I had a very strange interview process at Mozilla, which I'll talk about a little later, but I wasn't sure whether to take it or not. I got offered a bunch of other jobs that were in leadership roles, and I was like, am I making a horrible mistake? And I remember because I got an email from Mike Schrepfer, who, as we all know now, CTO of Facebook, who was our VP of engineering at the time. He emailed me as like, hey, just call me because I want to know like what's going through your head and whether you're going to take this job or not. And I called him, you know, it was like a Saturday night and I was sitting in my car and I just called him. I ended up talking to him for 2 hours. And he, you know, super nice guy. I can't believe that he made the time for me like that. You know, as just kind of a lowly engineer at that point. And he said, you know, I've done this a few times and I want to reassure you. He said, you know, he had been a CTO and then he went back to being an IC at Sun Microsystems and it hadn't hurt him. And in fact, it was probably one of the best things that he'd ever done. And so I, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid and I went to work for Mozilla. I was a senior engineer for a few years. I started off, one of the first things I worked on was the add-ons API that lets you install add-ons into Firefox. Then I ended up working on one of the legendary things was, so the support website, support.mozilla.org, or Sumo, as we called it internally, they said, we want to launch this. And right now it doesn't really run very fast. Like some people have been building it and the whole cluster can serve 8 requests per second. And we think that's probably not enough. And I was like, yes. So I started working on that. And then the marketing were like, hey, we've had this brilliant idea. We're going to launch Firefox 3 and we want to set a Guinness World Record for the greatest number of downloads of a piece of software in a day. Oh, and the support website is going to be like the in-product help. So you should expect to get like millions of requests on day one. And I looked at that 8 requests per second and was like, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, it worked out well. It actually stayed up, which was great. there's a lot of like grinding work there to scale it. But I learned a lot. It was a lot of fun. And after that, you know, I ended up working on a bunch of different web properties there. And ended up finally kind of migrating because, you know, I'd done so many like CRUD websites over the years and they start to get a little bit samey. And I ended up working on the crash reporting system. It was funny because I remember the very first day I was at Mozilla, I walked into a meeting room and there was a whiteboard. And on the whiteboard, it said, keep all data forever. And I looked at that and I was like, man, I'm really glad I don't have to work on that project. And so this was that project. and when I came into it, they were like, yeah, so, you know, we've been storing all of our data on NFS and it turns out that doesn't really scale. This is also a theme in my career. It's always like, this thing's not really working out for us anymore. Can you do the other thing? Do something else.
Yeah.
And we decided that we were going to migrate to Hadoop, to HBase. And we were super excited about that. And we were in the middle of that. And, you know, I went and had this conversation with some folks at Cloudera, which was like in seed stage, but they were like, oh, all these HBase people working there that knew what they were doing. And they said, you know, it's not really ready for use in production. I'm like, that is great. We are moving like terabytes of data to it right now. And it's in production. So yeah, we had some challenges. I worked on that and we managed to scale it, you know, I learned a lot about resilient systems for that. Like that was kind of a real turning point in my career. Like how do you make things degrade gracefully? How do you make them mostly stay up when they're sort of in a state of continuous partial rolling failure, right?
Yeah,
which is,
right.
That's where I was like, oh, this is how distributed systems really work. I ended up hiring a team, being asked to manage a team to work on that and a bunch of other back-end tools. And it was really fun. And some of the people that I hired then are people that I still work with today, and they are amazing, like one of the best teams I've ever worked with. I think of the folks in that team, people that I hired as individual contributors, one is now senior director of Firefox browsers. One works for me as director of systems, does a bunch of ML stuff. One of whom is like one of my most senior engineers who just can solve anything. I just got really lucky in hiring. I'd like to think I'm reasonably good at it and at growing people, but yeah, that was kind of a moment. Since then, is this one of the things that I've seen as a pattern at Mozilla and I've seen it a pattern as other companies, which is where sometimes you just kind of grow a team really fast where people are like, oh, hey, you solved this problem. So can you take this other team that has a problem and solve that too? Oh, and here are like four more teams. And by the way, now you're managing 100 people. and that changed really quickly. Like suddenly, you know, I went from managing 8 people to managing 100 people. It peaked at about 250. It's like 120
wow.
Right now.
Wow.
But all of that growth happened in like probably inside a year. So I had to learn how to manage managers very quickly, which was the first for me. So that was kind of surprising and kind of the whole action at a distance, right? Which I think is influence. And that's what you learn when you go from manager to director is how do I get things to happen through influence rather than authority, right? And that is super important. I remember having a conversation with a product manager once who was like, you don't understand how hard it is to be a product manager. Because when, you know, you're an engineering leader, you can just tell people to do things and they have to do them. You know, I can't tell people to do anything. I have to solve everything through influence. And I was like, that's, if you think that, you know, a lot of people are around and that's how stuff happens, you have it completely wrong. It's all influence pretty much. If you get to the point where you are telling people that they have to do something, you've probably failed.
Yeah.
It happens once in a while, but it shouldn't be every day. So, but yeah, so now, these days I'm responsible for basically everything Firefox related that lives on a server. So that is backend systems, data, ML, services, operations, security. what am I missing? A bunch of stuff, but it's a lot of fun. Oh, you know, sync and add-ons website again, which I've had in and out of my team a few times. I've done a lot and there's a few things that I think I'm sort of particularly proud of or things that I've particularly learned during my time here. I've learned about resilient systems and how to make distributed systems scale, which is probably the first really important thing. Probably the thing that I'm proudest of that I've done in my time here is a program called Go Faster. And I had started off being in an org that was not part of Firefox. And when we moved into Firefox, you know, on day one, I started working for a guy called Mark Mayo, who had been the CTO of Joyent and had just been made a VP of Firefox. And he was like, what ideas do you all have about how we can do things better? And I was like, well, I think we need to ship faster. You know, I'm basically at heart a web dev and, I can't believe that we only ship every like 6 or 12 weeks. Like that's not cool. And we should ship every day. We should ship multiple times a day. We should continuously deploy Firefox.
That's awesome.
And I remember one of my coworkers came to me and was like, you can't come in here and say those things. And I was like, well, if I don't do it on day one, I'm not going to do it. And second of all, if I don't do it, no one will. So we built this program and we found a bunch of ways to ship code to the browser every day in, you know, what we call like an off-train fashion because we have sort of our main release trains. And that's been really challenging and really good. Half of it was technical, right? Like how do we do this in a safe way? But the other half has been cultural change. And affecting that kind of cultural change was really hard and a huge learning experience, but probably one of the most valuable things I've done in my career.
That's really interesting. That's evolutionary versus revolutionary, right? Some of those changes take a lot longer to get in an org, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think you look back and see things, and people who said this can't be done, who now it's just their everyday work, basically. You know, I remember one of the changes that we made, I went to a meeting with people, I was like, come up with a plan for how to do this. And I went to it and they said, we didn't come up with a plan because it's too hard. And I said, no, I didn't say like it wouldn't be hard. I just like, tell me all the hard things, make a list of the hard things, and then we'll figure out how to make them less hard. But yeah, it was pretty funny. And, you know, we're there. These days, I think the two big things that I've been working on that I'm pretty excited about are experiment-driven development. So this whole thing of like cultural change and getting people to try things in a cheap way, right? Like what is the cheapest way to test your idea, right? Like that thing that involves the least amount of engineering, least amount of cost, least amount of risk, right? And sometimes that is, you know, fake doors on websites, and sometimes it's a survey, and sometimes it's an experiment. Sometimes it's a focus group, right? Like what are all the ways we can try ideas, but you know, early in the path, early in the scheme, rather than shipping something and then discovering it's something that people don't want. And the second big theme over the last year or so has been, how do we collect and use data in a way that is ethical, privacy preserving, and user respectful? And this is something that, you know, we've had to learn again the hard way, because people at Mozilla were very resistant to collecting data at all. It's like, well, if we collect data, that's, you know, against our mission, that's the wrong thing. And I'm like, well, I think we can do this. I think we can do this in a good way, right? I think we can do this in an ethical way. And some of that has been about process, and some of it has been building in safeguards, and some of it has been about novel technology and the application of that so that we actually can't invade people's privacy. So yeah, this is the things that I've worked on, and I'm still pretty excited about it.
Yeah, excellent. Just rewinding back to what you're saying through there, I was kind of excited when you mentioned the Firefox extension API. I was one of your most avid users maybe 10 years ago when Firefox 3 came out.
Yeah.
And I was doing a lot of white hat botting with it. So I got up to automating about 2,000 concurrent browsers at a time.
Oh, wow. We do a bunch of that too, right?
This was for Crux, right? We were doing data sentry where we'd show what bad ad tags were doing on publisher websites. So cool. It was at the behest of the Fortune like 500 companies that we'd do this. But yeah, we just had, you know, I did some math and I think I got to about a half a trillion web requests with Firefox 3.6.
That's really cool.
Anyhow, geeky, but
yeah, I mean, we do a lot of that too, right? Because in our, I'm responsible for our release automation and testing infrastructure. So, you know, we do a lot of CI and a lot of automated tests. And one of the things that's hard about that is we have to test on hardware for performance, right? Like something that's one of those things you can't do in the cloud. So we do all of our builds in the cloud and all of our services, but we have hardware so we can do performance tests and graphics tests, right? How fast does this render? You can't do that even on bare metal, right? Because you need graphics cards. And that also means things like supporting Macs in the data center.
Yep.
So all kinds of weird esoteric stuff. It's fun.
I'm going through a bit of this right now. My new startup, Vidiate, is all about recording screens and this kind of thing.
Oh,
and I found I have to deploy it on bare metal. I cannot put it in Docker. I can't virtualize it because you're recording off of a DSP, an audio device, and so forth. Yep. Anyways, geeking out. But yeah, this seems to be a common theme between us, you know, this big browser stuff. You know.
Yeah, that's cool. It's really cool.
So going back to, you mentioned in Strides about going from that small team and then all of a sudden it ballooned up and it was all about influence, but maybe we can unpack that a little bit more and maybe talk about some of the growth you went from being an IC and a really strong engineer to then leading the teams. And, you know, how did you ensure that you afforded your teams the same kind of opportunities and the same kind of growth that you went through yourself during that time?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, so I think part of it is, as an IC, you have different managers, and some of them are great and some of them are terrible, right? And I think that you model what you think a good manager should be based on that. You know, I've worked with some folks who like actively like probably shouldn't be walking the streets because they're not like mentally well people. You know, I'm sure I've worked for at least two or three sociopaths over the years. And, you know, it's like, well, that's the person that I don't want to be. I don't want to be the person that people are afraid of, like that when they come into the office in the morning, they're like scared. You know, so that's kind of like a worst case. And it's like, well, who are the best managers that I've had? Who are the best leaders that I've seen? And how can I be more like them? And then what things have I not seen done well that I think, you know, always think somebody should do this. This is how I think this should be done. And the thing that I figured out pretty early, and you know, this is not unique. Everybody has kind of figured this out now, I think, which is that autonomy is worth a lot, right? Especially for more senior people, like the ability to have control over your working life and day within reason, right? Being trusted to do your job well is super important. especially for people who are good, right? Like the better you are, the more autonomy you want, I think is basically what it comes down to. The opportunity to like learn new things, right? To not be asked to do the same thing over and over again. Constantly and, you know, without learning or growing and feeling like you're doing something important. So, you know, that's sometimes summed up as like autonomy, mastery and purpose. You might have heard that described as. So I thought those things were important and just like not being a jerk. The thing, I found a way to kind of express what I think is important in terms of sort of team norms more recently. And I think these have been implicit along the way, but I've gotten very explicit about stating them, which is that communication in my teams should be kind, direct, and prompt. So direct is you should say the things that need saying. If you think something's going badly, you should say it promptly, soon, before it gets worse. But there's no need to be a jerk about it, right? Like I think in our engineering culture, there's a lot of feeling like if you're criticizing something that you have to be mean about it somehow, like somehow that makes you look smarter or something. And I think that's not the case at all. Like in any way that you can make your feedback constructive, the better. And actually the prompt plays into that because if you talk about something early, you know, it's kind of like if something's going badly and you let it build up for 6 months, then you're gonna be really mad and you're gonna be able to be like constructive about it. But if you talk about it on the first day something's going wrong, then it's, you know, it's a small course correction and it's easy. So those are things that I think are important to me and have been important to me as a leader. The other one is I think it's really important to meet people where they are because everybody's a little bit different, you know. So those are kind of like I gave you the broad strokes, but different people need different things. Some people want more structure. Some people need more what I think of as like emotional management. Some people kind of want you to leave them alone, and some people want to like vent to you, right, or talk about how something is bothering them or what they're worried about. And some people need more of that than others. So things like that. People need to grow in different ways. And some people choose not to grow at all, and that sometimes that's okay and sometimes it's not. So that's, you know, I think it's just really about treating people as individuals, as people, right, and not as machines.
Yeah, about the feedback piece you said there a moment ago, I see it's also a two-way street, you know. Also, it's about receiving feedback and not taking it personally as well, right? And,
oh, exactly.
Go ahead, yeah.
I was going to say, feedback is a gift. If somebody has taken the time to give you advice on how to be better, then you should take it in that spirit, right? Like they spent time to help you be a better person and a better engineer, and you should absolutely like treat that with respect and try and fix it. You know, sometimes you got to think about something and think, is that really true? Do I agree with that? Sometimes you might choose not to act on something, but you should really give it your like due consideration and time to think about how you might apply that.
Yeah, definitely. And as I was going through my own arc, I found there's also a way to really give feedback in a more constructive way, you know, literally just asking the person first, like, can I give you a bit of advice? Right. Yeah. And then you're kind of giving them of course, like who wouldn't want that? Right. But
right, exactly,
also letting them know it's coming, you know, et cetera, but the small stuff, but.
And that's really, I think that's, again, that's a kind way to do it. Right. So you're setting people up so they're not surprised because surprises in feedback are almost always bad. I think.
Totally.
Yeah.
And we talk about that too, when we're talking about candidate experience and all of this kind of stuff. When you're interviewing people on site, they're very nervous, right? There's a fight or flight response to everything, and the kind of way to really diffuse that from the first moment. I like that. That's great.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
All right, so you spend a lot of time with Mozilla. I'm wondering if you ever went through points where you know the goals of the organization sometimes trump those of the individual or even of the team in terms of advancement.
Yes, that's a great question. So there's not always room for like people to move into the job that they want, right? Like I think that's kind of what you're getting at, you know. Sometimes it's like, well, I would like to be doing this, and it's like, well, that's great, but we need you to do that instead. So there's a few ways to deal with that, I think. Part of it is knowing what people want. So having clear conversations about the ways in which people want to grow, and then being explicit about what the options are. So sometimes, you know, so one thing I can have seen at Mozilla is, you know, there are certain career paths where you are going to have more likelihood to grow than others. And this is true at every tech company, which is that if you are working on the core thing or have skills that relate to the core product, you probably have more of a career path than if you're working on something else. So one piece of kind of general engineering career advice I have is it's, you're probably always better off working for a tech company if you can. And it's best if it's a tech company that does the kind of tech that you're excited about, right? Almost always more fun, I think, if you're like a serious geek. So one way this expresses itself here is you know, I had a team of folks that were like, we don't want to write JavaScript anymore because we think JavaScript is terrible. And I'm like, you know, and I was like, so there's kind of a few things here. And let me kind of lay this out for you from a career perspective. That's okay. Like, I think they wanted to rewrite the world and God, I don't remember what it was. Like one of the various things that like, you know, transpiles to JS. But it's like, so this is kind of the JavaScript company, right? And that is like, what you're saying is completely reasonable. It is okay to hate JavaScript, but just realize that it's probably not a opinion that's going to help you very much here. And probably not a thing that's going to lead to career growth here. So you have a couple of options. One is to like be okay with that. One is to suck it up and write JavaScript anyway and get good at it because that will actually help you grow. And the third thing is like go work on the JS team and make JS better. It's one of the few companies where you can actually do that. So, it, you know, there were a few different options there. That team was really mad at me when we had that conversation. I was like, and also we're not going to do this thing the way you don't write JavaScript because that's kind of not the company that we are, right? That just seems really strange to me. I had a long argument with them because they were sort of saying, you know, we should be able to choose whatever tools we want. And I'm like, that is fine within reason, but we can't have every team choosing different tools, right? Because that means that we have folks have to support all those different tools. We have to pay for all the different tooling. And it also means that we have limited ability for people to move between teams and grow in their careers, right? Like we do need to have some degree of standardization across the company. And that's, you know, probably not surprising. So a couple of these folks stayed, a couple of them left. And one of them, it was funny because this is like 3 or 4 years ago. And this year he tweeted at me and was like, hey, you were right. I was like, I can't believe it took that long, but I really appreciate it. You know, I think a lot of it was just like being really explicit about that. In other situations, kind of moving on from that, sometimes it'd be people will be like, I want to grow and I want to do something like this. And you say, I don't have that right now, but I'm going to watch for an opportunity. So it's really important for people to tell you how they want to grow so you can opportunistically, when someone says, oh, you know, I need somebody to work on a project that's like a real stretch assignment and it would be good if it was somebody who was shaped kind of like this. And I'll be like, I have the right person to do that. You know, so having those clear conversations. And I think to saying people, sometimes it's going to take a little while to get to do the thing that you want to do here. And sometimes it's like the thing that you want to do here probably isn't going to come around. So you need to think about whether you want to change teams or maybe change jobs. And there's kind of a, you know, that's the thing as a manager you need to be at peace with, right? I think I've heard it described as like your best people will leave you. You know, it's good for them. And that's okay, right? Like, I know the people like, oh, I feel like I failed because like my best engineer left. And I'm like, well, it could mean they failed. It could also mean that like they needed to learn something new or grow in a different way. And here's the good news, right? It's a really small industry. So you probably end up working with them again. Maybe at you sometime, right? Like that's the thing you can look forward to.
Yeah, sometimes they come back to where you're at too. You know, sometimes they return right back to you.
Yeah, they boomerang. We have a lot of boomerangs here. It's kind of funny. And the other thing that can happen is, you know, sometimes they come back as a client, right? Like they hire you to do something for them later on buy your product or whatever it is. So
that's great. So let's talk about some of those individuals. Yep. You were there for 12 years and you said you saw a lot of amazing growth and stuff. So you don't have to be specific, but like I'm looking for anecdotes, like really cool stories of like they were an IC over here and now they're over here doing this other thing or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a bunch of those. So I think particularly those changes are interesting. I talked about the person that's like the senior director of Firefox browsers now. So that's Selena Deckelman, who I think is amazing. I think she is not yet done with her career arc, right? I am super excited to see what she's going to do. But I actually hired her back when we were working on that HBase project because we had a really big Postgres instance and I couldn't hire a decent Postgres consultant to save myself. And I was like, look, we're just going to need to hire a DBA. So I actually hired her as a DBA. And that's quite a career path from A to B, as you may imagine.
Yeah.
She did a lot of amazing work for us. And when I ended up moving roles, and when I moved, I said to the person who was taking over the team I was leaving, listen, you should take her and put her in charge of release engineering. And they said, what? And I was like, she just has really good like systems thinking, and I think that she will fix a lot of these problems. So she ended up running release engineering. And then she ended up going over to Firefox and being a manager and being a director and being a senior director. And she had a similar kind of career arc that I had. Part of it is like just incredible degree of competence, you know, on her part, like she's amazing. But I think part of the thing that we did there was putting her to work on things that weren't necessarily obvious, right? Like not just taking people who are experts and having them do the things they're experts at, but having people who are like good thinkers and have them do something new that they can learn on the job, and it makes them even better. The other thing I've seen for both herself and myself at Mozilla, a few other people, is this concept of sponsorship, which is having someone more senior than you, not mentor you, but help you find opportunities, right? Put your name forward. When someone's like, oh, we need somebody to solve this problem, you say, well, I think, you know, Laura will be great at that. Right.
Interesting.
And that's really helped me. I can think of quite a few examples, and I've tried to do that for other people in turn, because I think that's super important.
You mentioned sponsorship as sort of an advocacy. How about a guild? Like what kind of net do these folks have as they're progressing through more and more challenging roles?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have recently set up like a formal mentoring program. And it's actually for a backwards reason. I think we've had kind of informal mentoring networks for a long time. And I've always said to people at work for me, you should have a mentor that isn't me, right? Like you need somebody outside your management chain that you can go to talk about stuff and figure out how to grow. And mentors can be like for one specific thing or for like, you know, everything. You know, it can be Yoda or somebody that you want to talk to about one specific skill, right? So we set up this program. And the funny thing is the reason for this was we formalized our engineering career ladder a couple of years ago. And one of the requirements to become like really senior to become a principal engineer is you have to mentor other people.
Yep.
I've described this before as like the most important product of senior engineers is more senior engineers.
Yep.
And so people are like, how do I find people to mentor? So we set up a program. So it's kind of a backwards reason, but that was why we did it. So that's one way, good way to build a network, I think. We have a lot of like informal group discussions as well where people get together. There's a lot of different forms that takes, you know, people get together to show like their projects that they're proud of on a Friday afternoon, or having like a morning coffee hangout in Zoom or whatever, where they'll come and talk about like what they're working on today, like an informal stand-up, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And those are maybe weirder for us because we're a very distributed company, but those are the ways that we have dealt with that and making sure that people feel like they have a network and that they have a team beyond their first team.
Okay. Actually, you said you had several. Do you have any others that come to mind, actually?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I really like to do in terms of growing people, especially when they are kind of new to my team, is try to figure out how to get them to grow. And the general shape of growth, I think said everybody's different, is I try to find a series of things that will stretch them more than they think they can do. Right. And I think that's the trick. Like you have to kind of break that mental model of like, you know, this is what I'm capable of. And we, you know, we have a lot of people in this industry that have imposter syndrome. You do get people like super cocky or whatever, but that's not like that's a different set of problems, which I'll talk about separately.
Sure.
But the vast majority of people are like, oh, I don't know if I can do that. Like, I don't know if I'm smart enough. I don't know if I, you know, have enough experience. I don't know if I know enough about this thing. And so the trick as a manager there is to give people things that are harder than they think they can do, but that you think they can be successful at.
Yeah.
Right. So they continually grow. You don't want to like overload them and have them break, because that's not a good experience. It's going to happen once in a while, right? It's okay to fail, but you try to want it. You want it to be like a controlled failure, if that makes sense, like to a level you expected. And one of the things I try to explicitly say to people is, look, I'm going to give you harder and more things. And for managers, it will be like, I'm going to give you more projects until you tell me to stop. So your job in this is to tell me when it's too much. Yep. Right, like when you have actually like hit a wall, you don't know how to do something, or like you're overwhelmed. I make the joke that it's like eating at a Brazilian steakhouse. You need to like hold up your red card and say, stop, stop, don't bring me any more steak, no more projects. And that's actually worked pretty well. And sometimes you have to remind people, like you realize they're getting like a little in too deep, and you realize they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so stressed. And you're like, remember I said you're allowed to tell me to stop. Is this the time? And sometimes they'll be like, hey, maybe it is. And someone's like, no, I think I can actually do a little more. So that's fun too. Sort of negotiating that line. I've done that with people. And fairly recently, I used to manage a guy who has a very strange job. His job is community operations, which is halfway between managing out bad open source contributors and encouraging new ones and making sure the code of conduct gets followed, and half being a sysadmin, right? Like administering community systems. So he's a very unique individual. And so we promoted him to senior staff. I think he is technically classified as a program manager because he's like in a class of one. There aren't multiple people with this job, so it's hard to figure out where he fits. And not long after we promoted him, he came to me. He's like, hey, there's this thing and it's really like poorly defined and I don't really know how to reason about it. And he's like, yeah, this is going to be really hard. And I said, yep. And then this kind of silence fell. He's like, this is the thing, isn't it? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, this is the thing that it means when I get promoted. Like, you said it's going to be hard. And I said, yes, it's going to be hard. And the reason that you have this is because I don't know how to do that. I hope that you'd figure it out, because like, I can't give you the solution because I don't know what it is, but I trust that you will. And he did. Actually kind of worked miracles on that specific thing. And it was nice. It was like, I honestly thought he wouldn't pull it off. So super surprised. It's a community management issue where a project that we used adopted a very strange code of conduct. Like, it was very odd. And he went to talk to the person in the project and was like, hey, it's kind of a problem. And the guy said, you know, everybody has just been yelling at me on Twitter. Like, people are saying you're terrible, you're a horrible person, and you are the first person that came to me and offered to help. So yes, I would really like your help. So that was kind of cool. Yeah, I was surprised how well that resolved. And it was really nice to see him grow as the person and as a community manager in that moment.
Cool. Any others?
I'm thinking. So one of the people that works for me is now a director. And when they started working for me, they were a graduate biologist. and I hired them because I was like, man, I really need somebody that knows like something about like data and how to deal with a lot of big data stuff. And this is before the word data scientist was a thing. I was like, I'm going to hire this guy because bioinformatics people know a lot about data. And even in the interview, you know, I was interviewing this guy and I was like, here's this architecture, like, tell me what you think is wrong with it. And this was like the crash reporting architecture. We were having all of these problems with the HBase and whatever. And so I explained how it worked. And I was like, okay, so what would you do to improve this? And he looked at me and was like, why would anyone design it like that? And it was really funny. You know, at the time it wasn't funny. And I was like, I don't know. Like, you tell me. We designed it that way. Tell me why I'm wrong. And I think he was kind of terrified at that point. And so with him, like, he grew a lot as an IC. He's always been like a really hard worker, and we literally like turned his hair gray one week when we started working on like out of process plugins. Like, we shipped a release and I looked and I was like, you weren't gray yesterday, were you? He's like, nope. but the funny thing was, like, I thought he'd make a really good manager. And I said to him, look, I need a manager and I think it should be you. And he's like, oh my God, I don't want to be a manager. And I was like, nobody ever does, but let's make a deal, right? Like, here's how I'd like to do this. If it's not you, it's going to be somebody else on the team. Do you want to work for one of these other people? And he said, no. I was like, right. So I think you'll be really good at this. I'm willing to be proven wrong. I would like you to try it for a year. And if at the end of a year you hate it, I will make you back into being an IC, go back to being an engineer, and we'll never speak of it again. And he said, okay, that seems like a good deal. And also it means I don't have to work with somebody else, and that seems okay. So we got to the end of the year and, you know, he was doing really well. And I said, so do you want to go back to being an IC? And he's like, no, actually. I was like, see, I thought that might happen. nice. You know, it's finding ways to stretch people in different ways and, you know, beyond their comfort zone. And giving people an out is actually really important. Like, I would like Definitely. You to try this, and if it's not working out, come tell me, right? That's a thing I've used a bunch of times. And sometimes it doesn't work out, but a lot of the time it does. It's surprising how often. Okay. So I want to talk about when people aren't doing great. And this is something, you know, it's all great giving people growth opportunities and having them grow into stuff, but sometimes we have to, you know, often we have to think about when things aren't going so well. And that can take a few forms. Sometimes it's like really early, you hire somebody and they never come up to speed, but those are not kind of so interesting, right? Like, that's more kind of a recruiting question, which we're not really talking about today. What I want to talk about more is when someone has been awesome and then they stop being awesome. And we've all seen it, right? Like, you know, and sometimes not awesome to less awesome. Sometimes it's just like fine to not fine. And there can be a lot of reasons. Sometimes it is a personal thing, right? Like, the classic thing I've seen so many times is somebody's getting a divorce, right? And they, guess what? Their output is going to suck for 6 months.
Totally.
Or they come back from parental leave and they have a kid that doesn't sleep, right? That's another one where you see like, yeah. And if you know they were good before, you'll know they get back to it and you give them something a little bit easier to work on, right? Sometimes people get into a rut. They've been doing the same thing for so long that they've kind of stopped growing. You know, they're not as enthusiastic about it. Sometimes they're in full-on burnout, like if they're working too hard. So there's different ways for dealing with that. I think the first thing is to have a conversation with them about it and try and figure out like what's causing it, right? You know, there are no root causes, but sometimes there are like a cluster of things for people anyway. Sometimes it can be like, I'm bored. Sometimes it can be, you know, I'm just really tired, right? Like, super burned out, can't deal with the stress anymore. And there's a few different ways you can deal with this. One of the things that I think is really important, and this is maybe a little bit radical, but, you know, I am nothing if not a troublemaker, which is that I think like people taking time off is really important. And a thing that we've done a few times unofficially for people is like a sabbatical, like go take a month off, or, you know, whatever it is. And just like, don't touch a computer and we'll see you when you get back. Often when people do that, and sometimes you can do this without the sabbatical, is give them something completely different to work on, like total change of pace. There's one guy we worked with here who I think was, had been working on the same thing for like 5 years, and he had this side project, which is in a completely different area. So his day job was like working actually at the time on MDN, which is the Mozilla Developer Network. It's where we have all of the documentation. People love MDN. Yeah, I know. Everybody's like, I love that website. It's great, right? Yep. So he was lead engineer on that for like 5 years. And so he got really burned out. And he had this side project, which was a security thing. And I had seen this and we're like, hey, maybe we should have you actually like go build that. Go build that side project. Build it for us. Take 6 months. And at the end of that, it was super successful. And we ended up transferring him to security engineering. Completely different side of things, like security engineering on Firefox, right? Being a web dev at all, but being like a browser developer. And he is so happy. I've never seen him so happy or productive, and he's doing great work. So that can, you know, it's like going to a different job at the same company, right? Like rather than having to quit your job, finding you a different job in the same place. One thing I found sometimes if you have people that are in a rut that are kind of underperforming, and this is very counterintuitive, but I've done it with great success. You know, at a previous job, I had a reputation for like the person who could fix underperformers. And for a bunch of them, it was the same thing, which was kind of funny, which was that the job wasn't hard enough. Sounds really silly, but like if you're unchallenged, and I think we've all seen this, like there's a lot of bright people who found school too easy and didn't have to work very hard, and they never had to work very hard, so they didn't, and suddenly the work got harder and the not working very hard wasn't enough to do the job. But I think one thing that is worth trying is, hey, you seem like you're not performing, I want to give you something harder to work on because I think it'll be more intellectually stimulating and I think you'll do better work. It is remarkable to me how well that sometimes works. Sometimes also if you couple it with a conversation about like, I can tell that you're really smart, right? You know, so the fact that this isn't going well tells me that maybe like you're working on the wrong thing. Let's have you work on something different, maybe something really challenging. It's kind of, you know, it's an opportunity for people to prove themselves, and a lot of people really rise to that occasion. It is not always the right tool for the job, but it's kind of a, I feel like the secret weapon that's worked for me really well a bunch of times. But you know, in solving any of these kind of rut and burnout problems, I think the key thing here is that you have to be creative, right? Like don't be afraid to try something really, really different, that, you know, might seem a little wild, but it's worth giving it a try, especially if you're in like a place of kind of last resort. You should try anything you can think of.
Yeah, that's great that in an org like Mozilla, there's plenty of places or potentials to lateral, and it's a big enough org, you can do that. And in some cases, you're saying they're even sustaining a whole brand new product line or a piece of one. That's great, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I'd say an anecdote I collected over a period of about 5 years in LA building and just doing really aggressive hiring is you talk to people in first contact and you're like, why are you in the market? Mm-hmm. And you start to see a trend line between certain companies, big ones in LA, where it's like, well, these folks are talented and they're great, but across the board, systemically, they're under-challenged. And it's because they've been acquired by a big, huge company, maybe, and then they lose their mojo. And there's this sort of turnover effect that happens for people leaving these big companies because they want to get back to what they used to have. And that's another kind of dead-end burnout rut track as well.
Oh, that's a super important one. Yeah. I think it's really important because one thing that's good for people to recognize about themselves is the environment in which they are do their best work or most effective. And one of those things is company size, right? There are some people that are just startup people. There are some people that do their best work at like a medium-sized company or like a company in extreme growth. And there's some people that do their best work at like a giant company.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, for me, for myself, I find I do my best work in like medium-sized companies, growth stage companies, because that's fun. I really like that rapid growth and figuring out like everything is just broken all of the time and you have to be like continuously, you know, you are rebuilding the plane while it's flying, and that's so much fun.
Right.
That's so much fun. But I wouldn't like to work for a giant company personally, right? Like I can't imagine working at like a 50,000 person company because I wouldn't feel like the work that I did made a difference.
It's been the same in my trajectory. Yeah. And I found that if I am in a very big company, it's because I'm out there as a consultant and it's for a skill set that they just can't have or don't have.
Yeah, same.
And or the mojo of what we used to call the treadmill effect. Like when they bring in people who are running faster because they have to, it kind of brings up the morale of an org. It could backfire, but you know.
Yep. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
What else do you have in your list?
I think it's off my list. I also have a bunch of notes about job interviews because you had some questions about
that. Oh, yeah. Well, let's do that. Let's segue into the wildcard round. Well, yeah, perfect. You know, it's funny in this series, everybody has such crazy funny ones. Even those companies that are, you know, too big, you know, big companies, there's some very interesting interviews. But what I'm looking for is not the successful stuff because it's like I went to a job interview and then I got hired. Yippee. Yep. You know, we're looking for the stuff that didn't go quite right and, you know, not to laugh at it, but to learn from it, right? So what do you have in terms of interesting job interviews from either side of the table that you've given or taken?
I think I've given more than I've interviewed more people than I have been interviewed by, probably. So secret about me is that I really like job interviews for myself.
Me too.
And I think I bet it's for the same reason that I like them, which is that you've spent a lot of time as a consultant and so have I. And I really like talking to new people and hearing about the problems that they're having. That's just really interesting to me and figuring out how to solve them. Like that's, you know, so job interviews are kind of fun. And I will tell you that like, it's long been my theory that you should probably, even if you're not changing jobs, probably interview a couple times a year.
Exactly.
You keep your hand in, you meet interesting people, right? And it's fun to learn about stuff.
You know, I've been telling people in this series, by the way, there's a period over 10 years that I interviewed about once a month. So I did 120 job interviews in 10 years.
Wow.
I'm not going to go into all of it, but it's going to be a little side project I'm working on, but to write about all of it because there's such crazy things. It's called Hustling for Hackers. I am working on
fantastic
about it.
That's great.
But and it's both sides of the table, right? So you hustle for hackers to get them into your org as a leader, but then you also, as a hacker, you need to learn how to negotiate for yourself and how to hustle for jobs and how to do it right. And if you do it right, you don't really need recruiters even. But going back to that, just to finish that thought, I would tell people in my orgs, though, like, you should go out and interview. And in fact, I'll give you a reference, too, if you want to, you know, and it kind of helps with that grass is greener syndrome people get, where it's like, I'm sick of this company, let's go over here. And it's like, it's not any better, really, sometimes. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And people are surprised that I'm like, you should interview. And they're like, oh, I'm like, because also, if you're here, it's because I want you to want to be here. I want you to have made the choice to be here, not be here because you feel like you couldn't get another job, right? Yeah. That's terrible. So from my side of the table, I've seen some really bad interviews. I have probably given some bad interviews. I think I'm moderately good at interviewing, but one of the occurs to me was I interviewed at a place and it was phone only, but it was a panel and everybody else was a native Russian speaker.
Oh, wow.
And like, there was just like such a failure to communicate. Like, I think they couldn't understand my accent. I'm Australian, obviously. And I had trouble understanding theirs. And there were a group of them and they were talking among themselves. So it was all very like the mumblecore job interview. It was not good. It was not good. And that did not go well. And I did not get that job. Another one I think that was really bad was, I remember it was like a whiteboarding interview and I was whiteboarding some stuff and I knew that I was not giving the person that was interviewing me what they wanted to hear. And that was obvious to me because the question, and I think we've probably all been in a situation like this, but they kept asking more and more leading questions. And I was and in the end I was like, clearly I'm not telling you what you want to hear. So why don't you tell me what that is and let's move on to the next question. And I didn't get that job either, but it was funny to me. I've been on the other side of that too, where people just kind of don't seem to know what you're asking them. That's a pretty common miss.
I think it's good to give an array of questions and allow people to just pass, you know, and have plenty of backup questions, you know. I have a similar one in that, not necessarily whiteboarding, or the worst is whiteboarding code, right? Not that either, but they gave me a live SQL test and I'm like, oh, I'm going to crush this. I'm going to crush this. But they put me on a machine. Actually, at the time, I was running SQL Server, right? And this company runs their jobs at 5 p.m., and the machine goes to 100% load. And this is like Windows NT, back when it really was pegged. Like, you couldn't even alt-tab out of the query builder or whatever. Oh, wow. Anyways, they go away for a while, and I'm talking they're gone. It's like Friday evening, so I think they're like in a kitchen somewhere drinking or something. And they come back an hour later. And I had nobody to tell, like, hey, I can't use this machine. And I got partway into it. So it looked like I got nothing done in an hour. And I was trying to explain to them, but they were over it.
Yeah.
They just basically dismissed me because I failed. And it's like, you guys gave me a machine that was locked.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, forget you guys, you know.
Even when I came here, so when I joined Mozilla, there were 80 people. And now there's like 1,100. It's been through that growth phase. Yeah, exactly. But when I started, we didn't have like HR, and we had like a recruiting person, but we didn't really have a process for recruiting. Like, we're much better at this now, for the record. But even some of the interviews I had here were just funny. I had one interview where the guy was asking me about like how to scale MySQL, and I was telling him a bunch of stuff, and he was taking like extensive longhand notes. And I think I might have like not hidden my reaction very well, like, because I think I had like an eyebrow raise, and he's like, "Oh, I'm not actually like interviewing you. I just need to know how to do this to do my job." So I laughed. I was like, "Oh, it's free consulting. That's all right." And then later in that same process, you know, I had a guy interview me, and he had been at Mozilla since the very beginning, like as one of the people who worked on Firefox 1.0. And he came, he's like, "You know, so here are web dev, and like, I don't know anything about web dev." It was just kind of funny within the direction of browser. He's like, "Do you know C++? Because that's really all that I can like interview." And I was like, "I know C++, but it's pretty rusty." And he's like, "Okay." And then he gave me like a job interview question on Duff's device. If you don't know what that is, go look it up. But it's basically what you get if you do like -F unroll loops. And yeah, it was very strange, very, very strange. I remember that well. But yeah, this, I've had a lot of weird interviews over the years, but that was one of the weirdest. On the other side of things, when I've interviewed people, I think probably the very, very worst one. Have you ever had somebody cry when you're interviewing them? Because I think that's the worst.
Yeah.
You know, and it was pretty early in my career. Like, I hadn't done a lot of interviewing at that stage, and I just didn't know what to do. Like, what I did end up doing was making the questions easier, right? Like, it wasn't a hard question that we started with. I think it was like very basic, like HTML stuff. And this person just started to cry. You know, they got up to the whiteboard, and I think like they touched that, you know, I'm sorry, I don't do whiteboard coding anymore, but this is a long time. It's like 15 years ago.
Right, right.
You know, they got a marker, and they put the marker to the board, and they just started to like bawl, like tears, like not even like a single tear, but like full on, like a kid fell over and skinned their knee kind of crying. And so like, you know, I got her a drink, and then we sort of, you know, glass of water and tissues, and like, let's back up. And I progressively made the questions easier and easier. And this particular case, I think the person actually really didn't know anything and had kind of bluffed their way into an interview, which was sad. Like, I, you know, nobody wants that. Nobody wants to say like, "Hey, you know, I think maybe this isn't for you, and I'm sorry it didn't work out, and I hope you have a good day," which I did call it early, but that was awful. Yeah. Like, I felt awful about that. I still feel awful about it. I hope that the person got a good job somewhere doing something that they felt better about. I think one of the other end of the spectrum, you know, I interviewed a really senior candidate for a leadership role, and other people on that person's panel and I were joking about it later that we were describing this person as racist Uncle Ted. And what I mean by that is, you know, everybody has a horror story about they went home from Thanksgiving and they have some relative that just like starts saying terrible things. Right, you're like, "I can't believe that like someone I'm related to thinks these things and would say these things." So we interviewed that guy, but he said those things in a job interview.
Oh, like, boy.
Right, not even like at a family holiday where the person felt comfortable and maybe had a bunch of drinks or something, but like in a job interview. So first of all, like, what a terrible person. And second, like, obviously a no-hire. But also, like, I wonder at, like, the level of poor judgment where they thought it was okay to say those things.
The lack of the filter and the self-awareness that is completely gone, right?
And this person had been a VP at a bunch of companies, and that was kind of terrifying to me. I was like, how did you get these jobs? How did you keep these jobs? Yeah, just like, absolutely horrifying things this person said. So,
what else do you have?
Well, I guess I'm kind of coming to list. I've had some pretty bad recruiter experiences as well, but I'm not sure what mine are like. Yeah, I'm not sure that mine are like particularly different from anybody else's. Like the usual, like, "Would you be delighted to like come here and be a junior Rails developer?" And I'm like, what about my resume? And I mean, I'm talking like 2 weeks ago, right? Like, about my resume makes you think that I want to be a junior
Nobody
Rails
reads.
Developer
yeah.
for like $35,000 a year in Actually, Oklahoma, right? Like, no.
I mean, we'll talk about the whole con game. That's part of my project I'm working on is all the cons, but you know, just recently a friend of mine got hired at a big, big, big firm. And I went over for some beers and dinner, and he's like, "Here, I want to show you something." And he opened up the console of what they use. And this painted a picture for me that I had always imagined, because I've worked with a lot of recruiters. I've done much more direct hiring. And I've been approached, just like you have, in so many wrong contexts. So by just seeing this console and the workflow and how they scrape LinkedIn, they do stuff. Yeah. The reason they're not reading is because they never went upstream to where you say, like, "Here's how you may contact me through LinkedIn," et cetera. Yeah. They're direct contacting you through tools they've built, and they lose the context. And there really is no excuse for not reading your CV. right? Yeah. And looking even for the most recent version of it before they reach out to you, because you know, they're supposed to be building a two-sided marketplace where there's respect and there's representation on both sides, because maybe you've gotten a lot of unsolicited CVs or redacted CVs from recruiters that are like, hey, I want your business. Just look at what I can get you. And they send you some bait or maybe, you know, just a random CV of somebody, et cetera. Yeah. And, you know, this, you know, so it's dirty from the candidate side of things. When I was at Crux, they used to call the front office and ask for us, you know, thinking that they could get us on the phone to poach us for a job somewhere else. Right.
Yep. Wow.
That's how aggressive it's been in my experience.
That is funny. I've had executive recruiters do that to me. Like when we have been interviewing people here, occasionally had someone say like, are you interested in changing jobs? And I'm like, that's really nice of you to ask, but no. That's it. Like, that seems a little unethical to me.
Like always be hustling, you know.
Yeah. Well, and the other spectrum of things, not just like the recruiters with the bad tools, but you'll get recruiters from the, like the big companies, right? You know, the ones I'm talking about who are like, are you interested in, you know, a fantastic leadership opportunity here? And I'm like, I do not live in San Francisco and I'm unable to move to San Francisco right now. And they're like, but why? Like they seem so stunned that I wouldn't want to do that.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I was like, yeah, there's all kinds of reasons. I remember not a recruiter, but I ended up talking to a guy at a hedge fund in New York who was looking for a CTO, and I ended up talking to him as like a, someone said to me, I know you don't want to go work there, but can you give him advice on how to hire somebody? So I he's like, he said, are you interested in this role? And I was like, no. He's like, I don't, you know, it's a great company and you seem like you know the right things. And I was like, listen, you're in Manhattan, right? And he's like, yeah. I was like, well, you know, I'm sitting here. I live on a farm. I work from home. I can look out my window and see deer and like hawks and stuff. And like, I know you would like probably pay me twice as much, but it doesn't matter. Right, there's a quality of life thing. So yeah, it's that's why I don't move to San Francisco. Lovely city. Love visiting there. Visit there way too often. But you know, the way I sort of jokingly describe it to people is 3 weeks a month I don't have to commute, and 1 week a month I have a really long commute.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So that's how it works out.
I'm right there with you. I spent about 500 days in San Francisco, but never lived there.
Yep, yep, exactly. I know how you feel. And earlier this year it was like 7 weeks out of nine, which is a little bit over the line for me. Usually it's more like once a month, which is okay. But yeah, I felt like a temporary resident.
Nice. Well, all right, Laura, thanks so much for joining today. This has been a great conversation. What a bunch of cool stories you had in your career and at Mozilla, especially, and all these different stories. So thanks so much for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. It's always nice to talk to you, Dave. It's always fun. It's fun to get to tell some of those stories.
Absolutely. Until next time, thank you.
Thanks.